Hey, Tripod people, you are about to hear part two of this story on Camp Algiers, the internment camp that detained Latin Americans during World War II. If you haven't heard part one of this series, go listen to that first. It will make part two make more sense. And after you listen to part one and part two, you can go to iTunes and write us a review, because that way a lot more people will find out about Tripod and then they'll listen to part one and part two also. Okay, thanks. Da 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 da. This is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan Levinson. Okay, let's do a quick refresher from where we left off. The United States has just entered World War II after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The FDR administration is anxious about additional Axis power points on the map. It sees Latin America as a potential threat, with Nazis hiding out and organizing with Hitler's party from afar. So the United States reaches out to Panama, Honduras, Colombia, and 15 other countries in Central and South America to assist in a roundup of potential Nazis. The result? Over 5,000 people, the majority of them innocent, stripped of their homes, property, jobs, and sometimes families, and deported to the United States to sit in internment camps.
I think it's been forgotten partly because it's a small story in the context of World War II, which was a global cataclysm in which more than 50 million people died. This was a sideshow. But also partly because it's embarrassing.
That's Max Paul Friedman, who you heard in part one of this story. He wrote a book on this topic called Nazis and Good Neighbors, the United States Campaign Against the Germans of Latin America in World War II. So, as he was saying, it's embarrassing.
Here was the creation of camps that were set up deliberately outside of the legal system in order to intern people suspected of subversion, against whom there was very little evidence. So it was an illegal operation that wound up being counterproductive and a violation of human rights. And it was sort of swept under the rug at the end of the war.
We left the story at the point where Camp Algiers on the West Bank of New Orleans became known as the, quote, Camp of the Innocent. That's where the U.S. put deportees who were not only not Nazis, they were Jews and Hitler resistors. They were relocated to the safer, more laid-back conditions of Camp Algiers, separated from the Nazi sympathizers who were sprinkled throughout the camps. So who were some of these Jews that had been deported from Latin America and then wound up in Camp Algiers? Max gives us some examples.
Werner Kappel, who was a 19-year-old German-Jewish refugee, who along with his father had been able to escape to Panama. They were picked up there by FBI agents because of reports that they'd been heard speaking German and therefore must be dangerous Nazis.
Werner and his dad were not Nazis, and neither was Otto Kugler, a dentist who left Germany for Honduras in 1930. When he was picked up and deported in the 1940s, all they told him was that he had spread Nazi propaganda. Kugler hadn't even seen any Nazi propaganda until he was thrown into a camp in Oklahoma with guys who said things like,
"Listen up, kid. In this camp, we're all Nazis, and anyone who doesn't agree will break his skull." And he watched on April 20th, which is Hitler's birthday, as some of the deportees would parade around singing Nazi songs and giving the Hitler salute.
So people like Werner and Otto were eventually removed from camps where things like that were happening to Camp Algiers, a Nazi-free camp. Marilyn Miller, a Tulane professor who you also heard from in part one, says internees in New Orleans had things to occupy themselves with inside the camp, and they were also allowed to leave for certain things.
We know that they had access to a small library that had books in Spanish and English and some books in German. They had access to some musical instruments. The residents of the camp were allowed to shop nearby, and they could even participate in Mardi Gras.
They'd be ferried over to the department stores of Canal Street, or they'd be sent over there for a parade. Equally important to Carnival, believe it or not, the kids of internees were also still allowed to learn.
Children who lived here were permitted to go to schools in Algiers, elementary school and high school.
One of the internees was even valedictorian of his high school. So imagine giving your speech at graduation and then returning home to fall asleep in your bunk bed behind bars. So internees like the valedictorian could leave, and they could have visitors. Here's Harvey Strum, a professor at Sage College in Albany.
It was members of the Jewish community who would come to the camps to offer services to the Jewish internees. For example, a representative of the Jewish Refugee Service in New Orleans, David Fichtman, came on a regular basis, sometimes three times a week. a rabbi from New Orleans came and held Jewish religious services at the camp.
It was the Jewish Refugee Service that first lobbied, along with the Jewish internees themselves, to get them to Algiers, away from the Nazis and other camps. And once they got to Algiers, it was the Jewish Refugee Service that worked to get them out. You're listening to Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson. By now, it's 1943, and innocent people have been interned for almost 2 years. The Jewish Refugee Service contacts the National Refugee Service and says, look, we've got dozens of Jews locked up in New Orleans, and we've got to get them out.
Well, basically, the decision has been made in the spring of 1943 to possibly consider them for parolee at large.
Here's what happened. Jewish families in New Orleans and a bunch of other cities agreed to sponsor a Jewish refugee and take them in until further notice. They were essentially on parole. As Harvey said, they were referred to as parolees at large. This happened through a series of hearings in New Orleans where community advocates spoke out against the detention of Jews and urged their release.
And again, it's the lobbying efforts of the National Refugee Service. You know, it's not like the government saying, okay, we're just going to release these people. Rather, it is because of the continued pressure of the National Refugee Service on the Roosevelt administration, on the State Department, that eventually the State Department and the Roosevelt administration as such decided that, oh, these people really aren't a threat.
And therefore?
What happens is in 1943, the Jews at Algiers, most are released on parole to places, again, like Detroit, St. Louis, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, with the assumption that once the war ends, they go back to Panama or Honduras or go back to Germany for that matter.
This is like a stopgap solution. They can leave the camps, but they can't go home and are basically on watch by an American foster family. And they need to report regularly to an immigration officer who's like a parole officer.
Six, however, remained at Algiers till the duration of the war.
And why were those six kept there?
In part probably because they were single males, as opposed to being families, and or because they could not find someone to essentially provide some kind of cooperation or some kind of sponsorship for them.
This was unfortunate for these six remaining Jews, not only because they had to remain behind barbed wire for another 2 years, but the so-called Camp of the Innocent became less safe. In 1944, a man named Kurt Ledecky was elected to head the internee committee at Algiers. He was not innocent. He was
a pro-Nazi and former advisor to Hitler.
Yeah.
And things turned a little bit sour,
to say the least. This happened because after most of the Jews were sent off to live with their sponsors, a group of pro-Nazi Germans were transferred to Algiers, and they elected Kurt Ledecky to head their internee committee. This is a guy who wrote a book called I Knew Hitler, and he meant it in a braggy way. So once again, Jews and non-Jewish anti-Nazis were persecuted. Then, a year or so after Ledecky becomes the head of that committee, the war ends. The camp gets decommissioned. But then no one really knows what happens next or what to do with all these people. Here's Max Paul Friedman.
The reason they couldn't be released initially is that U.S. officials couldn't agree that it would be okay to release them. They didn't want to send them back to their homes in Latin America because they had put a great deal of pressure on Latin American governments to expel them in the first place, like telling the Costa Ricans, if you don't hand over these Germans, we'll stop buying coffee and sugar.
Max says returning those people after that behavior, saying, oh, actually, these people are not dangerous, just kidding, would have undermined U.S. credibility. And there was another problem.
They didn't want to release them into the United States itself because they had entered illegally.
Which, remember, wasn't their fault, considering they were essentially kidnapped. And now the U.S. was like, oh, yeah, what we did was pretty illegal.
You have to understand that there was no legal basis for essentially kidnapping people living in other countries, bringing them to the United States, and locking them up. There's no law that allows for that. In fact, there are laws that forbid it.
Of the roughly 5,000 internees, less than 1,000 of them stayed in the U.S. after the war. Most of them wanted to return to Latin America and were ultimately able to.
Where they typically found that their property was gone and they had to start from scratch and sometimes to start a legal process to try to recover some of what they've lost.
In his article on this subject, Harvey Strum wrote, "Only Franz Kafka could have created a tale of German Jews being arrested as pro-Nazi enemy aliens and then being sent to the United States for internment with real Nazi sympathizers." But he says this bizarre and failed operation was a preview for more recent missteps that, according to him, our country shouldn't be proud of. Looking at this story, what does it make you think of when you think about the present day?
Exaggerating security concerns. To do a parallel with the Syrian refugees, that essentially the assumption is that every Syrian is a terrorist, making assumptions not based on fact and based on prejudice and biases.
Max Paul Friedman says there are some relevant questions that come out of this story that we as a nation need to ask ourselves.
What is the balance between civil liberties and national security? And does it require violating the former in order to ensure the latter? And this story seems to suggest that, at least in the case that I've studied very closely, it would have been much more effective for us to look for guilt in terms of individual acts rather than in group belonging or group identity. And that's a lesson that's important for our own time.
Tripod is a production of WWNO New Orleans Public Radio in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the University of New Orleans Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies. Special thanks to Evan Christopher for the opening theme music. Catch Tripod on the air Thursdays during Morning Edition and again on Mondays during All Things Considered. You can hear part one of this story if you missed it by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes. And at that point, you can listen to part one whenever you want, and then you can listen to part two whenever you want, and then you can write it a review, and then you could tweet about it, how you wrote it a review, and you could at Tripod NOLA, and then we'll get it because we're on social media. We're also on Instagram and Facebook, so check us out there. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson, and I'll tripod you later.